Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Mireille Génot, and you're listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Joining me today is Professor Michelle Commander, Associate Professor of English at the University of Tennessee in the United States. Today, we'll be discussing her new book, Afro-Atlantic Flight, Speculative Returns, and the Black Fantastic, published by Duke University Press. Professor Commander, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. I'm really excited to have you on, and really excited to discuss the book, which I enjoyed. I've been reading it alongside Yag Yassi's Homegoing, so it's been a really fruitful reading of both texts. So I wonder if you'd begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm originally from Columbia, South Carolina. I went to all of my schooling there in South Carolina from birth through my bachelor's, which I received from Charleston Southern University in Charleston, South Carolina. I then went on to Florida State University, where I completed a master's in English education and started a humanities PhD, but I eventually really got interested in cultural studies and transferred over to the University of Southern California, where I received a PhD in American Studies and Ethnicity in 2010.
So mostly South Carolina and then a little bit of California thrown in.
Right.
If you would tell us how the idea of Afro-Atlantic Flight came about, and in so doing, if you sort of explain what you mean by the term Afro-Atlantic and how it might be distinct from the term or the notion of the Black Atlantic popularized by Paul Gilroy.
Sure. Well, the idea for the book started when I was finishing up my first year at USC. A friend and I decided that we wanted to travel to Ghana, but we could not rationalize spending so much money without having some sort of project to go along with our it was an educational experience, but it was also tourism. And so we set off on our trip, and I had just taken a class in transnational feminism. And so I started in Accra by interviewing leaders of various women's organizations. Mm-hmm. But while I was doing that kind of informal investigation, I was feeling an attachment to the place. And I also seemed to meet African Americans at every turn. And I became very interested in what they were feeling. Partially it was a kind of a personal thing, you know, finding out if people were having similar experiences to what I had, and how it was they became expatriates in that place. And so I very informally started talking with those people as well as the folks who were working at women's organizations. And it later turned into my dissertation topic, which of course then became eventually Afro-Atlantic Flight. With Afro-Atlantic Flight, what I mean by that is that I'm thinking about the ways that not only African Americans in the U.S., but also Ghanaians and also Afro-Bahians are thinking about the prospects for Africa and the diaspora. And this is thinking about, you know, the kinds of ways that people talk about myths of triumph, the way that they talk about diasporic politics, and that kind of thing. I was trying to think about all of those concepts and ideas in concert with one another. Mm-hmm. And I try to not use Black, the Black Atlantic in the way that Paul Gilroy did, because mm-hmm. I felt as if there was not so much centering on Africa within that text. And I wanted to sort of think about slavery and how slavery has its resonances on many sides of the Atlantic. So I wanted to come up with a term that gave me some of that kind of flexibility mm-hmm. and would not be as tied to Paul Gilroy's work necessarily, just to kind of to sort of make it its own kind of expression of what I felt was going on with the psychic flights and also these actual flights that Black Americans were taking throughout the Atlantic world.
Yeah, that's a helpful distinction. Just a point of clarification. You mentioned that on your initial trip to Ghana, you were encountering a lot of Black Americans, and were these expatriates or these tourists or
a combination of both?
Gotcha.
But mostly because we were staying in the Accra area. Mm-hmm. They were mostly expatriates that I was coming into contact with at first. Mm-hmm. And then when I started looking more closely, then I began noticing the tour buses. But the places that the tour buses were going were on the coastline in the central region to Cape Coast and Elmina and so forth. And so, you know, as a part of our tourist experience, my friend and I, this is our first time in Ghana, we too had on our itinerary to go to the slave castles and so forth. And I met a whole lot of tourists in that way as well.
This is a good sort of starting point to get into some of what you cover in the introduction to the book, which is where your aim is to sort of demonstrate that the travels toward Africa can become problematic if they're clouded by this sort of individualist concentration, as you put it, on homeland returns. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about this sort of individualist concentration. And why you consider it problematic.
Right. Well, you may be able to tell from reading the book that I was trying to be very careful with the people's stories that I do cover throughout the book. I felt that for many of the expatriates, many of the tourists and people who are return travelers, that a lot of their movement was steeped in longing and feelings of loss and dispossession and feelings of being outsiders within the U.S. And so I wanted to honor those feelings, mm-hmm. but also just to suggest as well that there are some problematics in someone just being able to escape and not do anything with their own mobility. Mm-hmm. So for me, I talk about neoteric Pan-Africanism or thinking of new politics and new ways of thinking about not only looking out for the self, but also thinking about other African descendant peoples who are still mired in whatever circumstances across the Afro-Atlantic. And that is not to suggest that we are people who are victims, because I think in the book, I definitely suggest that we have been able to make a way out of no way across the Afro-Atlantic. But just to suggest that the very fact of living under global racism is something that we all need to be attending to. And it's not just about one being able to get out, so to speak, but it's also about ensuring that the politics and the ways that that person who's able to get out is thinking about things is also about thinking about getting everybody free, mm-hmm. right? And that's thinking about that through cultural production in very kind of everyday ways as well. And so in the book, I do talk about the cultural production in the first chapter, alongside these, you know, sort of more individualistic flights. But I think the arts and the politics are things that everybody can involve themselves in one way or another. And that's where I kind of sort of trouble this very Western American notion of freedom that is, you know, that kind of way that we we're told that we're supposed to be in America. We're supposed to, it's a dog eat dog world. You get it the best way you can. These kinds of colloquial ways that we think about negotiating this space. I'm trying to think with this book, think through the ways that we can be more embracing of a wider swath of people rather than just thinking about the individual.
So that's interesting for me for a number of reasons, because it seems that you, again, to quote from the introduction, it seems mm-hmm. that your argument about what's at stake is for there to be any sort of unification. This is a direct quote: for there to be any sort of unification and implementation of a truly transnational political column to address the emotive and systematic ways in which Black people are socially alienated, what some may understand as an efficacious and indefatigable Pan-Africanism, continental and diasporic Africans must recognize this impact of slavery and post-colonial histories on Black communities worldwide. And so so I think that that's one of the really interesting things about the book is this the global scope of the approach of the speculative and all that. I wonder though, you mentioned of course that the one of the ways to get away from this sort of individualist conundrum is through what you call neoteric Pan-Africanism. Mm-hmm. And the definition that you offer in the book is new, and you just alluded to this, but new mm-hmm. underground political expressions, including the fantastic, within cultural production. And I wonder if you could say more about this, because and something that I found really interesting was that this is not a notion. This neoteric Pan-Africanism isn't, as you said, synonymous with or contingent upon literal returns.
Yes, of course. Well, I was thinking about a couple of things. The first is I was thinking about the way in which the notion of Pan-Africanism is so tied to the history of Black American tourism and expatriation, especially to Ghana. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the ways that the government in Ghana in particular has used that narrative to promote not only diasporan tourism, but also diasporan investment in the nation. Mm-hmm. And there's a way in which the kind of kinship, the kind of solidarity, the sort of beautiful logic of Pan-Africanism that the earliest visionaries were thinking through in a way has been used to very different ends by the government. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I was thinking about how adding something like neoteric is just a gesture toward ensuring that we understand that it's something new that we're doing, that it's more speculative in nature, and that for Black Americans who are turning their attention to places like Ghana, it's not just Ghana, but it's other countries in West Africa and all over the continent, really that folks are looking toward, that they understand that it's not just about their physical movement to these places, but it's about a sort of shift in the mindset. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just about the Black American condition, but it is one that's very much concerned with the ways that global racism impacts people across the Afro-Atlantic. And that's what I concentrate on in the book, but that could be expansive, right? It's global racism. But it's something that people need to do in a way to shift their mindset about how these things should function. And one of the quotes that I use within, I believe it's in the intro, or maybe it's in the chapter two. I talk about Maya Angelou's travel to Ghana for 2 years in 1960s. And there's a moment in which Malcolm X makes his trip to Ghana. And one of the things he says to the people who are there, the expats who are there, is that they are needed within back in the U.S. to help fight the civil rights cause. And he basically suggested to them that there needs to be a shift in the mindset, that Africa should be something that's within their mindset. But it doesn't mean that everybody needs to then, you know, sort of leave the U.S. and migrate to Africa. And I think that this is very important. Number one, it's not feasible for everybody to leave because there are definite ways that folks need to have the finances to support a life abroad. And we can talk about this more later, perhaps. But you know, one of the things I noticed about the expatriates in Ghana and in Brazil is that these are folks who, for the most part, are of retirement age, or they happen to make a great deal of money that they can live off of, and not people who are somehow professional, of the professional class in these countries. And so I think that's a great point that Malcolm X made to those expatriates then. And I think it's something that we should hold on to when we're kind of thinking about what Black resistance might look like, right? It's one thing to sort of say like, okay, well, in South Carolina, this is going on. I'm only focused on that. But when you start looking at the roots of capitalism, of empire, and so forth, you see that Blackness has always been treated as the abject by various Western powers. And I believe that a new form of Pan-Africanism, if we're going to sort of think about it, is one way that we can come up with a kind of politics for survival. And when I say neoteric Pan-Africanism, I definitely kind of couple that with speculative notions. And again, I'm thinking about cultural production and what we can see in the arts as well, and how all of these things are kind of speaking to one another, the politics and the arts.
Well, and so to get into the arts, the chapter one, which is titled Fantastic Flights, The Search for Ancestral Traces in Black Speculative Narratives, really focuses on cultural production. And specifically, you undertake some close readings of speculative literary and filmic texts that explore these literal and figurative returns to Africa. And also the sort of limits or, you know, limits or impossibility, possibility of return. And I, you know, I'm always interested in why people, why authors select certain texts for analysis, and yours is a particularly interesting mix. And I just wonder if you would sort of say why you chose that particular set of texts.
Right. Okay. Well, that is, I believe chapter one, it might be the longest chapter in the book, or one of the longest in the book. And wow, why did I select this? I wanted to ensure that I demonstrated the ways that the literature and the films are indicative or expressive of the kinds of longings that we see in actual returns. And so I wanted to sort of tease out the threads that I saw between the fictionalized literatures, like Octavia Butler's Kindred, but that I also saw in the nonfiction travel narratives, like Eddie Harris's Native Stranger and Sadia Hartman's Lose Your Mother. And so what that ended up doing for me is number one, showing the threads that I could then sort of weave together with what went on in my Ghana chapter and my Brazil chapter. But it also demonstrated to me the ways that post 1965 artists were very much thinking about what Africa could mean to the Black American, right? Mm-hmm. It demonstrated that these artists were noticing that the promises of the Civil Rights Acts, these are, that were passed in 1964, 65, and 68, did not necessarily do all of the work of the sort of Freedom Project, that people were still thinking about how they could become truly free. And that was very much connected to the sort of reclamation of history. Mm-hmm. People wanted to be able to engage in the imagination. And this is through the fiction. And this is through actual migrations that they were able to take. And so what I tried to do in chapter one was demonstrate how all of those desires work together, how notions of shame, notions of dispossession, notions of the importance of connections to African spirituality, and so forth, all kind of worked together and demonstrated something about Black America in this post 1965 moment.
Yeah, and I think end of the chapter, you talk about how shame and ignorance of the collective slave and ancestral past are characteristics of dispossession. But the idea of return through travel toward Africa has the potential to slake these sentiments. And that, I think, leads us nicely into chapter two, which is titled The Production of Homeland Returns, Misrecognitions, and the Unsteady Path Toward the Black Fantastic in Ghana. And here you take up in more depth this post-civil rights migration of expatriates. As you mentioned, Maya Angelou and W.B. Du Bois were mentioned as these sort of almost pre-civil rights expatriate figures, but then there's a significant wave, largely instigated by Nkrumah's very intentional effort to attract people home, which you've already sort of alluded to. And so I'd be really interested to here, especially having just passed the 60th anniversary of Ghana's independence, how you see the arc of the sort of triumphalist narrative, the Ghanaian triumphalist narrative started or centered around Nkrumah, how that plays out in this post 60 civil rights, let's say, period.
Right. That's a great question. It is absolutely compelling the way that the Nkrumah triumphalist narrative still has the power to attract Black American tourism and Black American expatriation. So back in the 1950s, when Nkrumah helped Ghana reach liberation from the British colonial power, he sought out Black Americans in particular to help him build his fledgling nation. And this included Black American professionals, Black American artists, and so forth, who very gladly traveled there. And they worked with him, alongside him, until the moment of the coup. And then you had a kind of moment for, I would say, around 15 or 20 years, where there was not as much African-American expatriation to the place because of, you know, Kwame Nkrumah basically being deposed. It wasn't until Jerry Rawlings gave an apology and start, you know, sort of welcoming back, using that kind of language of kinship mm-hmm. in the 1980s that you had more of an interest kind of gin up among Black Americans to travel to the place. And that's a kind of very rough history. Please read the book, those who are listening.
Yes, yeah.
That's a very kind of rough
sure.
story of what went on. Right. But it was kind of like, you know, 1950s, Black Americans were invited to the place. It wasn't again until the 1980s that there was increased interest and also a welcome from the government to Ghana to tour. And also, you know, folks began expatriating there. And I should note, and I believe I note in brief, that there is also an Afro-Caribbean presence within Ghana as well. So I keep focusing on Black Americans or saying African Americans. But I do want to make that note there as well. But by the 2000s with this tourism industry, between UNESCO, the World Bank, and the IMF, there was a kind of push to the government that, look, you have this African diaspora. They, you know, have, I think the number that was passed around when I was doing a lot of my research there was they have $6 billion of monies that they use for these various discretionary purposes, and they could be using them, this money to travel here and consume some of the cultural artifacts that you have from slavery. And partially that was what helped usher in large numbers of Black Americans. I believe the number is something like 10,000 African Americans travel to Ghana each year. And that has continued on. So by 2007, when Ghana turned 50 years old, there was a huge push for diasporan investment. And part of that second chapter, I discuss the UNIA chapter from New York that comes in, and this is one that was at that time led by Marcus Garvey's son. Mm-hmm. And one of the ministers, the Minister for Tourism and Diasporan Relations, came to that meeting and basically said, now we're not trying to say that all of you need to move back to Africa, but you have a responsibility to this place. Mm-hmm. It was a very curious moment. It was, you know, I was looking back and forth between Garvey and this minister, like, okay, what's going to happen here? Because you're telling the son of Marcus Garvey, who was all about African, you know, African diasporic people moving back to Africa, you're telling these people who have these desires of this place that we're not saying that all of you need to move back here. The language of Pan-Africanism was being used and brotherhood and kinship and sisterhood and all that stuff was being used in a way to suggest something about responsibility, but not necessarily about the possibilities for those people making a home there. So you could see some breaches in the way that the government tried to sort of take up the language of Pan-Africanism, but it also shows the kind of, I talk about it in the book as kind of diasporan returns, thinking about the financial capital that can be made off of loss. So you could see some of that within how the government has talked about tourism and why it's so important for African diasporans to tour Ghana or to move to Ghana in certain kinds of ways. And I say that not to offer a blistering critique of the Ghanaian government, but just to show that there are all kinds of reasons why people promote cultural roots tourism in Ghana or expatriation in Ghana, right? So it could be based in sincerity. Yes, these people may have ancestors who were kidnapped from this land, but also it's the very real thing of needing or desiring, you know, the kinds of capital that will help sustain the Ghanaian, sustain Ghana and its people.
Right. So and I don't think it's even necessarily a cynical outlook to suggest that there's certainly a recognition that there, that the longing that, that this taps into is a very, sort of profitable, wellspring, if you will. And, so yeah, that, and that to reiterate or to echo, please read the book. But you know, that interchange, you know, with Julius Garvey and the UNIA, you know, that delegation is really interesting. And, you talk about how, Garvey sort of does articulate his desire to work with the Ghanaian government. But essentially the equation has to sort of balance out, right? That, you know, proper infrastructure needs to be in place and that sort of thing. So it is, it's interesting. And you also talk about this problematic assumption that Black Americans, in large measure have the sort of disposable income that should be heading, you know, being spent supporting, Ghana, in particular, which you also point out that I found interesting was sort of, you mentioned, I think in the introduction, the sort of, the idea that, that at times, for that, while Black Americans are not the only diasporic people who claim, to represent Africa, they and others occasionally position Black Americans as single people of the diaspora. And I thought that that had an interesting symmetry with the way it can seem that the Ghanaian government also sort of centers itself, right, as this disposable, the $6 billion should be largely headed in sort of a Ghanaian direction. If you could touch on this idea, I guess, that's related to, which is the homeland myths and Pan-Africanist rhetoric, why you think that they're especially appealing to Black Americans?
Sure. I think that they're especially appealing to Black Americans because it feels nice when someone says to you, someone who doesn't even know you says to you, welcome home, my brother, my sister, we have been waiting for you. What happened to our ancestors was tragic. One of the things that I noticed with the tourism at the slave castles in particular is that there is a very deliberate way in which the tour guides offer their narrative about what happened in those spaces. I noticed that the narrative shifted depending on the composition of the groups. And there is something that occurs. And again, I try to be as even-handed with this as possible, thinking about the idea of sincerity, but it feels like a real acknowledgement of one's grief and one's pain. Because people see their contemporary experiences rooted in the history of slavery. And because, you know, Ghanaians have seen African Americans within that space for 60 years, maybe more, I think that, you know, they really got the narrative down. In some ways, it is consistent, even if the expressions of Pan-Africanism are riddled with holes, are not exactly what Pan-Africanism means. This narrative about brotherhood and about Akwaba and welcoming and the fact that they're suggesting that you have been missed from the place is something that very much attends to the emotions of the people who are traveling and are desirous of that very kind of recognition. And that's what it is. Here is this country. You go to this country, the president, the police officers, most of the people there look like these Black Americans, mm-hmm. right? Looks, they perhaps look like someone that they are friends with or mm-hmm. that are someone that's in their family and so forth. So the optics of the place, the sounds of the place, this narrative of recognition is very much enticing. Mm-hmm. And it's something that can be sustained for a week-long tour to mm-hmm. Ghana, mm-hmm. or perhaps 2 weeks. Occasionally, and I mentioned this in the book, tourists who are in a market looking for things to take back home for themselves or for their family members, you know, picking up their souvenirs, may be hit with the word Obruni. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And realize that they're recognized as strangers. Mm-hmm. Obruni has all kinds of definitions, including stranger or just someone who's not from this country but is Black, mm-hmm. or it could mean white person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of ways that people use that word. But when that happens during tourism, it can be hard to come back from. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But typically what ends up happening is that tourism experience is so nicely curated mm-hmm. that kinship narrative is sustained mm-hmm. and people are heartened and they want to get back to Ghana. Mm-hmm. As soon as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've noticed that with a lot of people, the way they talk about the place is that it felt like home. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere that if they can do it financially, they want to get back to the place. Mm-hmm. Now, things happen differently once folks are living in Ghana as expatriates, which I go on to detail. Of course, I use Sadia Hartman's Lose Your Mother mm-hmm. for part of my evidence, but also the ethnographic interviews that I was able to conduct from 2005. So those earliest kind of informal interviews and then my trips back to Ghana over that long period, you begin to see how the narrative gets fractured by the everyday encounters people have. Mm-hmm. With Ghanaians.
One of the things that the book has prompted me to revisit is Skip Gates' sort of PBS film from 15 years ago now. But I think it was The Wonders of the African World, where he sort of made a similar pilgrimage and just, as you mentioned, talking about this being desirous of that recognition and these narratives of recognition that are sort of played for profit, but are also deeply resonant with visitors for the first time and even repeat visitors. Mm-hmm. I guess continuing on, but in a different way, the third chapter, We Love to Be Africans. And is it, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but is it Sadaj?
Sadaj.
And the Effective Performances in Bahia, Brazil. Here you sort of talk about this intra-diasporic move toward Africa and the narratives produced in particular by Black Americans who spend time in Bahia. And here again, we're sort of talking about the tourism industry and again, a sort of post-civil rights, post-65 Black American heritage focus on Brazil. And I just wonder if you could sort of talk about, again, why Bahia let's start there. Why Bahia?
Okay. Well, I should probably give the history of how I even encountered it for the project. I went to Ghana for the first time in the summer of 2005. And that fall, I went to the OSWAD conference mm-hmm. that was held in Rio. And my friends and I encountered a woman at the conference, and she inquired about our possible dissertation projects. And I told her what I was thinking about as far as expatriation to Ghana. And she said to me, you know, there is an expatriate collective in Bahia. And I said, oh, really? I had no idea that there was an expatriate collective there at that time. And so I traveled there myself and found it. Of course, I did some research beforehand and got some leads, had some interviews set up before I went there, and then used the snowball effect to meet other Black Americans there. The collective is much smaller than that is in Ghana. Mm-hmm. The Ghana estimate ranges between, people say 1,000, some people say 5,000, so in the thousands. And it's smaller in Bahia, but at that time that I was doing the initial research, it definitely was growing. And there's so many reasons that people select Bahia as that place that they find Africa. Mm-hmm. The first, and I thought that, you know, in that chapter, I talk about the Avocet venture that was geared toward having at least once a day flights, direct flights from the U.S., possibly places like D.C. or New York, directly to Bahia. And some of the rationale for that project was that folks could get Africa without the war or disease or trouble that they would encounter on the African continent, which is so problematic. The several reasons why that's so problematic. But there is a way that Africa does feel sufficiently, there's a way in which Bahia feels like Africa. So it's something that's different from what Black Americans have experienced here in the U.S., but it's also significantly different from what they experienced here too, if that makes sense. So there's that notion, which is very problematic about getting Africa in the way that they can understand it. And there's also the fact that Bahia is home to a population that is estimated to be 80% African, of African descent. So there's the optics of the place, similar to what was functioning in Ghana, and that people feel as if they see their family in Bahia. There's also a kind of change in their narrative about slavery. So where the narrative about slavery in Ghana is very much about the breach of the transatlantic slave trade, about the kidnapping of people and so forth. One of the things that I noticed that differs in that narrative in Brazil, in Bahia in particular, is that it's very much aligned with these stories about how the enslaved people were able to triumph over their oppressors. And this was in slave revolts, but it was also in spiritual practices like Candomblé, where these African slaves, enslaved people, were able to align their spiritual gods with the Catholic saints and were able to kind of hold on to their traditional expressions in a very kind of radical, subversive fashion. So those are some of the reasons why Black Americans have sought that place out. It's the myths that and stories that people continue to tell about the revolt of enslaved people. It's the seeming ability of those people to maintain connections with Africa through their spirituality, through their food, through their dance, and so forth. And there's a way that Black Americans feel as if, many Black American tourists feel as if Afro-Brazilians have been able to maintain authentic connections to Africa that Black Americans have somehow lost, right? And of course, one could get into conversations of if that's even true, and give examples of the retentions that we have in the United States from Africa, and so forth. But what I noticed with the actual expatriates and the cultural roots travelers is that is a belief about among many of them that these are the people that we would have been if we did not, as Black Americans, lose our connections, our heritage, our traditions from Africa. It's as if slavery as it exists in the U.S. somehow defeated all of that or beat it out of us, be colloquial about it. That's something that many of the expatriates and cultural roots tourists believe about the United States. And, you know, it remains to be seen that is truly the case. And of course, I think you can see the way I see how I feel about it when you read that chapter.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about how Black American sentiments about Brazil were and remain bound up, this is a direct quote, with the notion of a particular type of paradisiacal futurity based on the imagined absence of racialized oppression. One of the things I think that's particularly interesting about this chapter is that it's not just, I mean, you do quote someone who says, you know, Bahia is the new Ghana. And so in that sense, it's sort of this continuity or it's this more accessible, you know, there's no, as you said, it's more accessible. There's no, you bypass the war, the disease, the jet lag, you know, it's much more reachable than Ghana, but it's also, Ghana and Brazil talk to each other in important ways as well, and so I wonder if you would talk about that aspect of the chapter.
The ways that there are connections between what's going on and
because as I said, you know, part of it, it talks about how part of what you talk about is that. In a certain sense, because of accessibility, Brazil has not entirely supplanted, but become an alternative destination, right? Literal destination. But in terms of the relationships of you talked about the Tabum people in Ghana,
right?
And so I thought that those are just interesting intersections and connections.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I actually ended up adding the section on Tabum people after, I had a Fulbright in Ghana for the academic year 2012-2013, and I was asked to be in a documentary on the Tabum people. And I was just struck as I was standing back listening to various folks be interviewed about Brazil, I was struck by the way that they constructed Brazil as a motherland for them. So the Tabum people are descendants of these African enslaved people who were in Brazil, who revolted and were repatriated along the West African coast, including Ghana. And they were given some amazing land in the Jamestown area of Accra that was oceanside and so forth. They still have their community there. There's a Brazil house there. But it was interesting the ways in which they constructed Brazil as a motherland that they wanted to get back to. And it's not as if they somehow believed that they were not Ghanaian. It's just that they understood that their ancestors also had a life in Brazil as well. So it's very interesting how these people who had been kidnapped and or sold from Africa initially made it to Brazil, made it to Bahia, right? And were repatriated back to West Africa, had this very Afro-Atlantic identity about them. And they wanted to eventually see the place of Brazil. So I thought it was very interesting how longing functions. One of the other things I talk about at the beginning of that chapter on Bahia with the Tabum people is an art project, a letter writing project that happened between these descendants of those folks who were repatriated from Bahia. And this is all along they're writing the letters, exchanging letters between West Africa and also in Bahia as well. So I thought it was very interesting, the expressions of longing and wishes for connections that these people had. It was a very kind of interesting moment of coalescence, I think, showing how desire functions on all these different registers, and the kind of dispossession that the institution of slavery wrought among so many different people that you wouldn't even expect having these kinds of feelings of longing, and are so desirous of reconnecting with people who are also descendants of these people who went through this very traumatic experience.
Well, and to sort of follow along with that, and that, and to move into the fourth chapter of the book, what's interesting about this chapter, which is titled "Crafting Symbolic Africas in a Geography of Silence: Return Travels to and the Re-narrativization of the U.S. South." This in lots of different ways, this longing is sort of turned inward, right? For if we're thinking about Black Americans in particular, and in this chapter you take up the way cultural producers in the U.S. South apply speculative thought in many ways to disrupt a lot of narratives that persist through time. And I wonder if you would talk about this cultural production that you choose to highlight in this chapter.
Okay. Well, I start that chapter by thinking about a moment that I actually had forgotten about until I was writing the book, or it had not occurred to me very often, at least. I was thinking about a class that I took when I was a student at Charleston Southern. It was on Southern literature, and part of that course was a tour of the haunting and the ghosts of Charleston. And I remember that there were not many tales of enslaved people within that tour. There was only one. And I began thinking about why there was such an absence of that very thing. There's so much in Charleston about being able to almost time travel to the Old South. You have the cobblestone streets, you have the horse-drawn carriages and the plantation homes and all of this stuff. But the topic of slavery is rarely broached. And at that time, that was probably around 1999, it was in the late 90s, there was not a whole lot in the narrative of Charleston that included slavery. And I, you know, sort of think through my time, even as a child in South Carolina. I mean, I mentioned that I grew up in Columbia, but I really grew up in the Lower Richland area of Columbia, and also in Eastover and Hopkins, South Carolina. And these were all the sites of the plantations on which my ancestors labored and died, and also lived, of course. But I wondered in that chapter what speculation looked like over time. So I think about moments like Decoration Day. I mean, we just had Memorial Day yesterday. I was thinking about the ways that enslaved people after the war would go and decorate with flowers the tombstones of those Union soldiers who had, fought to help free them. I think about the sort of post-1965 ways that you had Pan-African entities go into the South or make demands of the South for land so that their people, Black people in the U.S., could basically be expatriates within the nation, have their own country within the U.S. So in that chapter, I think, well, the chapter before that Brazil chapter, I think I ended with something like, what might a politics of non-surrender look like? What might it look like on the ground? And so I look at the moments that you had the Republic of New Africa demanding that these 11 Southern states grant some space within the states for Black people. I look at the way the Oyutuji Village in Sheldon, South Carolina was founded in the 1960s. And they suggested that they were the only African village within the U.S. And I also look at the ways that Black Americans, who were not necessarily people who were pointed at as heritage preservationists, but were everyday people, how they challenged what was memorialized about slavery, about the history of the Civil War within these very contentious spaces within the South. And I particularly look at South Carolina, but there are also moments where I talk about places like North Carolina and the establishment of Soul City and so forth. But I was very interested in what that might look like in the South, what it might mean to sort of re-narrativize these histories and what we think we know about the South. And people have been very active. Again, it's not always people who are attached to some kind of formal organization or some political organization, but everyday people who basically say, look, I have money in my retirement, and I believe that there should be some kind of memorial to Nat Turner or to formerly enslaved people or people, or to recognize what our people went through. And so here is this money. And so that's part of what I do in that chapter, is just show what it's looked like on the ground within the contentious space that is the South. And we can see that sort of happening today in Louisiana. In Alabama, basically saying that now it's against the law to remove the Confederate memorials and so forth. So I, kind of think through what that meant, what it meant for Bree Newsom to remove the Confederate flag from the state house and so forth. So that chapter is about how it might look on the ground, how a sort of politics of speculation, what that might look like on the ground, how we might be able to challenge these narratives in a speculative fashion and demand more from our governmental officials to sort of, offer some form of reparation to the Black community for the institution of slavery and everything that came along with it in the aftermath.
Yeah, and one of the figures that you highlight, is Joseph McGill. Right. He's a historical preservationist and a Civil War reenactor. And he's sort of gone to various plantations, starting with I think the Magnolia Plantation and sort of outfitted himself in shackles and sort of reenact slave life. But he has like a larger project to attract financial support for the restoration of sites of slave life. And in that sense, you say, I mean, I think what I thought was interesting about that figure is, in addition to everything you just said, was the things that you've previously alluded to in terms of democratizing master narrative and encouraging this sort of global participation in, if I'm not repeating myself, in re-narrativization. So one of the things too, and if you go into more detail about this, you just alluded to it, but these sort of Black separatist schemes and in particular the African Oyutuji Village in Sheldon is a particularly interesting case, right? And especially this notion of being a U.S. expatriate within the United States. And creating and sustaining African selves, and if you could talk about that, I think that like I said, it's one of the more interesting parts of the chapter.
Sure, the Oyutuji Village was indeed a very interesting site to include for the book. As I mentioned previously, they were founded in the mid-1960s, and this was after their founder traveled to Nigeria and basically wanted to recreate what he saw there in a local village. And they have a kind of Yoruba spiritual form of worship that they feel is the most authentic in the Atlantic world, basically. And they kind of hold that idea about the authenticity of what they have there because they have not syncretized their ancestral worship, their gods, their goddesses, with any kind of Western faith. So they believe that they're more authentic than, say, what's going on in Brazil with Candomblé. Okay, so that's getting into kind of specifics about how they formulate things. But what that place has done over time is educated what they suggest is hundreds of families over time. There was a period where there were more than 100 people staying there. In the last few years or so, there's, you know, only about 30, 35 people who actually live on the compound and so forth. But one of the things I found interesting in my research is that I attended the Gullah Festival in the Lowcountry, and that usually takes place around the Memorial Day or Decoration Day celebration. And what's not always on people's itineraries when they're attending the Gullah Festival with their tour organizer is a trip to Sheldon from Buford, right? So Buford is the site of the Gullah Festival. And then one must travel about, I believe it's 25 or 30 minutes to Sheldon to go to Oyutanji Village. And one of the moments that I talk about within the book is of this group who clearly half of the people in that group did not want to go to Oyutanji Village. There's a way in which people attach African spirituality with voodoo, and many of these people are Christian believing folk who have misconceptions about African spirituality and had no interest in getting off of that bus. And so about half that group, maybe more, did come off of the bus to have a tour. And so I, as a scholar, who's some sort of a researcher, just kind of like joined the group and sort of watched everything that happened. It was really interesting the way that we're, you know, they basically were told you have to hurry up. You have, you know, 15, 20 minutes to go on this tour. And at a certain point, the bus driver is blowing the horn for them to come on and so forth, because the other folks who were on the bus waiting for them wanted to go to the Gullah Festival. They felt as if that group of people who have retained African traditions and African ways was what they thought was legitimate. They didn't see what was happening at Oyutanji as legitimate necessarily. But those people who got off of the bus at Oyutanji, when the bus driver blew the horn, he had to blow the horn several times. When he blew the horn, they were just like, oh, ignore him. We want to keep learning. There was a woman that I was standing behind or walking behind, and she was just saying, you know, I want to know. I want to know the real story. And so, you know, it's very interesting how Oyutanji served for many years as a place where folks really thought that they were getting a connection to Africa. But now it's seen as this place, and it's been written about over the years by local newspapers, the white community in that county and so forth, as weird and curious, and as if it were a community that was somehow harboring criminals from these black radical groups and so forth. But what it's done for, you know, another group of people is offer sustenance. It's offered them a connection to Africa. And, you know, one of the things I try to get across in the book is that really these stories that we tell about Africa and spirituality and so forth, their truthiness really doesn't matter as much. Being able to prove, you know, everything really doesn't matter. It's about how people are imagining a space or keeping a space, holding a space that is liberating for them. They're not hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to get closer to Africa. And that's kind of like the takeaway from the book. You know, even when I think back to what's going on in Brazil, one of the things that I offer in that chapter is this idea that these people are longing for a connection to homeland as well. And perhaps, you know, what they're doing there, these sort of, they're called myths, but it doesn't mean they're lies, right? But right. Stories and ideas that they believe about their connections to Africa are very similar to, I would say that the emotions that undergird how these stories are passed on and so forth, very much parallel the kinds of feelings of dispossession that Black Americans themselves feel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I forgot to say when we were talking about that chapter on Bahia too, is that there is a belief amongst many Black American expatriates, at least at the outset there was, that Brazil somehow did not have a race problem.
Right, right.
And that is something that was promoted by the government, the federal government of Brazil over time. After slavery ended, there was a promotion of this idea that there could be a creation of a Brazilian race, this sort of mixed race population, and that racism would somehow go away. But people sometimes, when they just do the tourism, they may get that. They may go away with that. And so I traced a couple of people who were, who believed mm-hmm. that very thing. And they could have, there's one person I talk about in that chapter who traveled there as a tourist a couple of times before he moved there permanently. And then after he invested all of this money in building a boutique hotel and noticed how race functioned there, he, you know, was basically kicking himself for believing what he thought he saw. And so that plays a big role as well in Black Americans thinking of that place as Africa without the racism and so forth, because it's very much promoted in some tour guides narratives and not so much so in others. So it depends. Things have changed over time, but there is this idea that somehow the American dream, this pursuit of life, liberty, and especially happiness, is one that could be located in Bahia, Brazil. Mm-hmm. And there is a promotion in the narrative in Bahia of kind of, honestly, it almost feels like a speculative kind of proposition. Mm-hmm. It's not living your life as a victim or feeling so despondent, but trying to find spaces of joy, which is something that we should applaud. But, you know, there are very real issues going on in Brazil, and Afro-Brazilians have fought and have organizations, and they've had organizations for so many years trying to also work against these various forms of oppression that are all steeped in the sort of hatred of Blackness within that society. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind of racialized system. But again, because of the way that idea of Brazil as a racial paradise was passed down for, I guess, a couple hundred years or so, maybe not as much, maybe not a couple hundred years, but you know what I mean?
Right.
For so long. It's still something that has kind of stuck, even though that is not the case within the space. But it's a very kind of interesting Africanized space. I didn't write about this in the book, but one of my favorite restaurants to go to was a vegetarian restaurant in Salvador, the capital city of Bahia. And it was owned by a Ghanaian man and his Brazilian wife. And he just said that Bahia felt like home. I didn't write about it, but it's just very interesting how he felt, you know, if he was going to be anywhere outside of Ghana, Bahia was that place that he found was so much like his home in Ghana. So it's very interesting how that place is kind of authenticated.
Right.
As African, even by this man who was a restaurateur there.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know, to sort of reiterate what I said earlier, one of the things I, you know, found compelling about that chapter is precisely these, this sort of, crosstalking of Brazil and Ghana and more widely. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you sort of talked about that, that mm-hmm. arc from a sort of early 20th century and before, sort of, mm-hmm. as you said, post-slavery construction of Brazil as this sort of utopia that then gets tempered by realities as mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. experience them. You know, sort of speaking of, I guess, limitations and possibilities for return in terms of returns, your conclusion is titled "Say Me My Name: Genetic Science and Emerging Speculative Technologies in the Construction of Afro-Atlantic Reconciliatory Projects," and here you talk about collaborative cultural production. Mm-hmm. But also about you also speculate about the turns that Afro-Atlantic speculation might take with things like genetic, or rather DNA testing. Mm-hmm. And you highlight a case study or two of folks who've used this technology to, I guess, strengthen these mm-hmm. sort of claims of connection. And I wonder if you would sort of talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. Well, I was very much interested in thinking through what these DNA tests, like from 23andMe and Ancestry and so forth, meant to African Americans. And I remembered seeing so many of these commercials either suggesting that family stories about where the ancestors came from were all wrong. Or there was another one about African-Americans where the man basically said, I had my DNA test done. I was able to use Ancestry to look through all of these records. And I found out that my, you know, something like great-great-grandfather was formerly enslaved, but became a businessman. And there was a way that the science was, you know, basically positioned as a way for folks to find such triumphalist narratives within their DNA. Mm-hmm. And so I just started, for that chapter, I was just thinking about what kinds of stories people might find, but also the connections that they may locate between people on the African continent proper. And so I do kind of go through one such case, but I was also sort of thinking about what I found. So I actually, for that chapter, I actually did the DNA test myself so I could understand exactly how it worked. And one of the things that occurred, well, there's a couple of things that happen once you submit your sample to these companies.
Right.
Once everything is processed, the first is that you get a breakdown of your DNA. So the DNA that you got from the random ancestors that you got them from, right? Mm-hmm. So it's going to vary from yourself to your brother or your sister or from yourself and your parent and so forth. But it gives you a breakdown of these places you've come from. Sometimes it's by region, West Africa, or it may say you're 10% Ghanaian. Mm-hmm. Or you're 34% Nigerian or however it goes. But it also gives you a list of your relatives. So people who have taken these tests, and they give you an approximation of how close you are kin. So it could be if your mother or father has taken it, that would show. But typically for many Black Americans, around the fifth cousin to eighth cousin is where one may get an African cousin show up mm-hmm, in that mm-hmm. DNA. And of course, all of this is sort of based in a kind of scientific speculation about mm-hmm. the connections of these people. But the story that I tell in that chapter, that concluding chapter, which is really short, but what I tell in that chapter is about this man who's able to find a specific connection to a local village and is able to receive an apology and all of this kind of pomp and circumstance for his return and so forth. So I was thinking about the possibilities of that and how various countries will respond once Black Americans began touring because of their connection, saying that, you know, most of my DNA is from this particular country. Mm-hmm. African ancestry told me that my people come from here, how they're going to respond in return. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember which West African nation it was, but one of them basically said that if people can prove that they can show their DNA test, they would give them some kind of diasporan visa or dual citizenship or some such. So it'll be interesting to see how that will work later on, right, as far as sort of legitimizing their kind of position in those places. So it's not just we're some woeful Black Americans who come back to Ghana as a potential place that our ancestors could have been drawn from, but right. I have ancestry told me that right. I have, you know, ancestry from this place. And it'll be interesting to see what the government does, what these various governments will do with that information in the future. Because again, that one case I talk about in the book, there was an apology extended and so forth. And some of the sort of threads that I've seen, some of the ways that Black Americans have been responded to in Ghana, for instance, is that a chief of a local village may say, oh, you know, welcome here. We want to allot you this amount of land and we want you to build here and be here as our brother and sister. And then there's a kind of exchange that happens where the expatriates may help support that village financially because they feel a kinship with them and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see how this works later on. And there are all kinds of Black American, US-based organizations are thinking about repatriation mm-hmm. in Ghana and so forth, trying to collect money on sites like GoFundMe mm-hmm. and so forth to sort of to make it happen. So it'll be very interesting to see how this works. If you go on Facebook, there are groups. Some of them are secret groups, but there are groups for people who have ancestry in Cameroon or mm-hmm. From Benin and so forth, you know, and these are like, I forget how they're titled, but it's something like DNA tested diasporans.
Okay, right, like certified, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a certification. If you have your certificate that suggests that you have some ancestry in this place, come here, and then you may have some people who are Cameroonian or whatever country there, just kind of welcoming them and, you know, trying to guide them. And so forth. So it's very interesting how all of this is taking a different kind of speculative mm-hmm. turn, using science as that kind of authenticator rather than the fact of the institution of slavery.
To echo, I think, yeah, it really will be interesting to see how all of this plays out, especially, I guess, given the history of everything from Sierra Leone and Liberia to Tunji Village to, you know, to see how, how all of this goes on to the future. And speaking of the future, can you tell us about what you are working on now?
Well, I am still thinking about speculation. I can't quit it. I am looking now at a project that does not involve travel yet, which I'm kind of sad about. Whenever I was doing my research over those, 9 or 10 years, I suppose, people would always just look at me and say, oh, we feel so sorry for you, Michelle. They would say it sarcastically, going to Brazil and going to Ghana all the time.
Right.
but now I'm looking at I'm looking at a project where I'm thinking about the usage of the arts as technologies during the Cold War period. So I'm thinking about how speculation, Afro speculation, kind of developed during that period in response to and alongside everything that was happening with the space race and NASA and so forth. Looking at the kind of lead up to what we talk about today is Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking particularly at still looking at that post 1965 period. So looking at the 1960s approximately to around 1990, thinking about the music and the literature and the visual arts that were coming out during that time period, and what these cultural producers were doing in response to or in concert with what was going on as the U.S. sought technological prestige through the through NASA and the space race.
Yeah, that sounds really, really interesting. And I definitely sort of put in a placeholder of love for you when, you know, when that project reaches book form for you to come back on the podcast to discuss.
I would love to. Something to look forward to.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you about the book, which I enjoyed very much. And so folks, today you've been hearing me talk with Professor Michelle Commander, who's Associate Professor of English at the University of Tennessee, about her book, Afro-Atlantic Flight, Speculative Returns and the Black Fantastic, published by Duke University Press. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for having me.